Hello, dear internet strangers. My name is Kevin Carlson, and thank you for listening to our first episode of Talking in Obscurity, a companion podcast to the blog Writing in Obscurity. And today I'm joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
And we are talking about books, like all days. For our first episode, we wanted to talk about a book that we both really love. It's a book called 14 by Peter Kleins. It's my favorite book I've read as an adult. It's the first book I always suggest to everyone because I really, really love the narrator on Audible. His name is Ray Porter. How this podcast is going to work is much like my blog, Writing in Obscurity. We're going to do a non-spoiler section at the beginning where we just talk about the high level of what we like about the book, what it's about, little details like that, and then we will clearly tell you when we're going to switch over to a spoiler section. And we'll let you know right whenever we're about to do that.
It's always exciting. You know, it's the this book is kind of the introduction to, at least for me, an Audible, maybe like audiobooks.
Yeah, the first time I listened to it, because I have since read it as a physical book, was I bought it in 2012. I'm going to look really stupid because I know the exact date, my blog post. But I believe it was 2012. And it was one of those daily deals. And whenever I was looking at it then, it was these great reviews. Never heard of Peter Kleins, though. But like for $4, I rolled the dice on it, and I could not stop listening to it. I listen to it normally what I do with my reading is I switch to different things as I'm going on, so I never get bogged down. But I just blew through this in 2 days.
It's a book that I really feel like, you know, because when I first got it, it was literally the first book I ever got on Audible. So it was literally for weeks, the only thing in my Audible library was 14. So, and I agree, I really felt like I was riveted by the story, a lot of it, but it's definitely sort of a combo deal because I feel like the story is so good. And obviously we talked about the narrator is so talented and he's such a good voice. His voiceovers are incredible and his whole like performance of it, because it's very much a performance. I mean, you can obviously read, you know, the sort of traditional book and really enjoy it because it's a very good story. I still think it's probably his best work overall. But I think I would say a lot of people that I talk to about this story, I always recommend the Audible version because I feel like you really get something with the performance aspect of it.
Yeah, like Ray Porter has this ability where he can do so many different voices that I forget that I'm listening to the same guy. I'm amazed that he can go from just your normal guy to an older, grizzled military guy to an Indian woman, and he does the accent, and it's not offensive, and like I believe that I'm listening to a woman almost. And like there's a certain amount, like, you know, it's a man doing a woman's voice, but the fact that where I give him the most props is he doesn't just have like one female voice. He has multiple female voices, and you can hear it and know it instantly what character is speaking. Of course, they do the attribution where Zila said, and so you're never going to get confused or anything, but you can hear who's talking, and you know which character is talking, and it could be two female characters talking to each other. That is incredibly difficult to do as a voice actor. Not that I am a voice actor, I just have this nasally annoying voice all the time. Again, thank you for tuning in. It's always going to be like this.
He does not have a cold. I can attest that. This is not, he's not sick. This is just how he sounds all the time.
This is just me. I just have this voice. The biggest thing in this book that I like is it's really in my wheelhouse because it's science fiction and it's also a horror story. It's Neo-Lovecraftian horror, which H.P. Lovecraft is obviously what that subgenre is named after, and he is one of those literary figures which, whenever he was writing in his day, he wasn't well known, but he inspired all kinds of things like this book. And there, you'll, if you ever read Lovecraft, and I would suggest that you read Lovecraft, you'll see how his influence has affected all kinds of modern horror, from the movies you watch to other books. You should read other books. As a book blogger and now podcaster, keep reading. Stephen King is also really inspired by Lovecraft. If you ever, if you like Stephen King, you'll probably like Peter Kleins.
I think it's a pretty fair way to look. I think Peter Kleins is a little more pop culturally hip.
Oh yeah.
Than a lot of, like, because he's not an old guy, but he's not really, I mean, he's not young either, but you read, like, listen to a lot, read a lot of his books. A lot, there's so many, like, references. It's very referential. And not in a bad way. Not in a way that comes off as hokey. Not a way that's, in a way that comes off as very natural, because people reference things. You know, I think a lot of times writers try to make things timeless. You know, so they won't, they try to, like, exist in this bubble, which can work. But I, what I like about this story and this book is that it doesn't exist in the bubble. You kind of know what year it is based on what the people are talking about. And you sort of know that these are real nerds. I mean, yeah, the dialogue is a little perfect at times, because it's like anything, any like TV show or movie or book, whatever. Yeah, it's perfect. Everyone's as witty as they need to be.
Yeah, and in my review of this that I put on the blog, I mentioned one of my problems with it, which is a slight problem, is that just what you were saying, is the dialogue is a little perfect. There is a moment when a character references a show called Torchwood, and everybody gets it. And it's one of those moments that's like, not everybody would get that. But like, they just roll with it so that the flow of the story keeps going. And that's an intentional choice, of course. But like, when you got a group of people where this guy's in his 60s or 70s, this guy's in his 30s, this girl is just out of college, what are the chances that they've all happened to see a spin-off from Doctor Who?
Yeah, that's sort of, and I think it's a fundamental problem with a lot of media. That's not really just a Peter Kleins thing. Mm-hmm. I think that generally, especially in like nerd sort of subgenres, you know, horror, science fiction horror, there's a lot of that sort of perfection in terms of people's dialogue. Everything kind of comes off as like a Friends episode, mm-hmm. where everyone is just immediately knows what to say, how to say it, the way they want to come across. They're only awkward when the story needs awkwardness.
Yeah. And like my thought on that is, we don't want our characters in fiction to perfectly speak like how we speak in reality, because you don't really want to listen to or read somebody trying to reach for that next word, sort of how like I'm doing right now. You see how that's kind of grating? Like, you don't want your random person, like, you don't want Ross wandering in during a Friends episode. And the reason I'm thinking about that is because I made a Friends reference at one point about this, and going, what are we doing today? It really like slows down the flow of the dialogue. And while authentic, it isn't very, it doesn't work well in fiction. And when people try to replicate that, I think that it's better to have the too perfect, the air on that side, versus to go with the too authentic, because you're then wasting a lot of words and a lot of space.
I think, yeah, it's probably the best way to describe it, because you don't, perfection is one of those things where, yeah, it can be kind of weird, but I think it's kind of that uncanny valley of like the written word, mm-hmm. where so perfect, you know, it's whatever you know. But when it gets to that too realistic, it's almost like more obnoxious.
Yeah.
Kind of like what you just said, you know, I feel like that is a sort of a great way to look at it in this way. And this book does a pretty decent job of, yeah, the dialogue's perfect and everyone kind of gets every reference pretty easily and pretty quickly. But the story moves along at such a good pace. And this is a story that, you know, without, you know, spoiling anything, when it starts, you have this sort of idea of what this story is going to be. And if you pick up this book blind and you have no idea what it's about, and no one tells you what it's about, you would probably think, where's the story going? Because the first, I would say, like, small part of the book, probably the quarter of the book, it seems like a very day in the life of this dude just moving into an apartment. And he can't figure out why the rent's so cheap.
Yeah.
Meeting his like cast of character neighbors. If you had just told someone this is just a random book about these people's lives, they probably would believe you. And it's this beautiful, it doesn't punch you in the face when it like the science fiction, the sci-fi and the horror elements come up. It's a real gradual sort of turn to sci-fi. And I think it does a really great job of sort of subtly little clues here and there. And you start, I think, as sort of, you know, you become like the main character where you're starting to pick apart this, like, well, that's weird.
Yeah.
Why is it like that? And then you, as the reader, start kind of like wondering why, sort of in addition to what the characters are doing, wondering why it's this apartment's so odd. Mm-hmm. You, as a reader, start doing the same thing. Like, wait a minute. I thought this was just about an apartment building. Why is this like...
Why is this happening?
And then it gets weirder and weirder and weirder, and like in a good way. And I'd say the last probably third of the book, it starts beating you over the head with it. But you've earned that right to be beaten over the head with it, because it goes from zero. It doesn't go from zero to 60. It's not a BMW. But once it gets going fast, it's going downhill. It does not stop. And to the point where I feel like the ending, if you listen to it on Audible, the voice acting of certain elements are super creepy. And I think, unlike a lot of, like, you know, traditional books versus an audiobook performance, I think it does it justice, because usually, you know, your head's going to sound worse than what it is. But I think the way the narrator sort of articulates some of these characters, it comes off as way more unsettling.
Yeah. Like, whenever I heard his performance at the end there, that was it got me the first time I listened to it. And I think that's a great point, how it is this sort of day in the life, and at first you don't know what's going on. There are these little mysteries that happen, and it just, the setting pulls you in, because what Peter Kleins can do that Lovecraft could never really do is his characters are really engaging to me. Where I often say, and I've said this several times before about this, is that I could listen to these people talk about anything, because just of how good Ray Porter's performance is, and how good, like, I feel that Peter Kleins does dialogue, where it's, even though it's perfect, like we said, it's going so fast, it's bouncing around, and like, you just want to know what does she think? What does he think? And like, I really enjoy that moment of just listening to the characters talk to each other and figure things out. So we're coming up on about the middle here, and we're gonna make that switch over to talking about this in spoilers. What we're gonna do is I'm gonna describe the synopsis a little bit, and we're gonna move from there to a more in-depth analysis. So at this point, I'm belaboring this. If you don't want any spoilers, this is your time to stop listening and read the book, and then come back and listen to the rest of this. And download it twice. Why not? I mean,
or don't. We're not cops.
Yeah. Or whatever.
Or be spoiled and then be mad about it. Whatever you want to do.
Do whatever. Do whatever you want to do. So 14 starts off, and the very beginning is this guy is running away from people who have stabbed him, and he knows he's about to die. And you don't know why he's running away. You don't know why these people stabbed him. He just needs to get away from them, and he knows that he can't be caught by them, because if they catch him, they could torture him, and he could reveal something that will kill everybody. Not just everybody in the local area, everybody everywhere. And right then, after that, bam! We are now in Los Angeles, and we meet our protagonist. His name is Nate Tucker, and Nathan is at a party that he wishes he hadn't accepted to go to. It's an after-work thing in this bar, and he's sitting there, and he has his current problem of the day, in his life, is he needs to find a new apartment because his roommates are... buying a house, and he has to move out. And he doesn't have a lot of money. He has a shitty job. Luckily, somebody at the party knows about this building called the Cavatch Building, which gives... It's explained to him that the rent is extremely cheap, and that the guy who was telling about it, he lived there, it just wasn't for him. And that's where, that's your first, like, why wasn't it for him? And he just kind of like, oh, plays it off. I just never felt comfortable there. Never really explains. But Nate's desperate, so he follows up on that, and he ends up going there, meeting with the rental company's representative, and she shows him around. He ends up moving in because it is very cheap rent, and these are big, huge apartments in L.A., and, like, the rent is super cheap, and that's not a thing you're going to find in Los Angeles easily. And it's this big windfall for him. And as that scene's coming to an end, the first odd thing that he notices in the building before he even moves in is there is a cockroach. And not what you want to see in your apartment building that you're moving into. But the strange thing about this cockroach is it's jade green. And it like scurries away. And he basically says, oh, that was weird. And they're like, don't worry, we're going to get an exterminator, and we're going to also get that elevator that never works fixed. None of those things ever happened, by the way. Future spoilers there. He moves in, and he starts meeting his neighbors, and there's the girl next door, who is unfortunately... My day job is I'm a banker, and this poor girl is checking her credit every day, and that's what's ruining her credit, other than the fact that she has debts. That's off topic, but, like... she's that kind of person. And she's a waitress, and he meets this woman named Veek, and she's the computer expert who gives everybody Wi-Fi. And then he eventually meets my favorite character, a guy named Roger, which I think is your favorite character as well. Not Roger. Tim. Tim
Farr.
I got Tim and Roger. Tim is an older gentleman that has moved in, and he's like the super fit, like... I think the description is like he's like all gym teachers rolled into one. In Nate's life at the Cavitch building is there's always one more little mystery, and he starts investigating it. And one day he's investigating, and then Veek comes up to him, and she shows him something that's completely odd about this building, and that he had been living there for a couple weeks, and there are no power lines that go to the building. And that's... and, like, nobody even thinks to look at it, because who actually walks around their apartment building? But yet they have power. So they get more and more of their neighbors involved in this mystery of... not just the power lines, but, like, they find things underneath the paint on their walls in their apartments. And there's, like, these... schematics for everything. And then there's, after they do that, they find that everybody's apartment is not standard. Like in most apartment buildings, every unit has the same layout. Everybody's is different. So it's just another mystery. And they end up going into the basement. And from there, they find that there's this locked room. And they trick the landlord the building manager out of the apartment building for a little while, and they go in and investigate down there. And when they get down there, they find this big safe, and they make plans to investigate this weird safe they find in the basement. And after that, whenever they break into that, finally, they find all these tunnels under the apartment building, and they go all the way down. And it goes down like a mile underground. And they find that the building is being powered by these big generators that are pulling energy basically straight from the earth because there's a fault under there. And after that, the realization is that the building itself is one big machine. And the reason it's called 14 is they eventually investigate the apartment 14, which nobody lives in. It's all padlocked. And whenever they open the door, this is when the sciencey horror really kicks overdrive. They open open 14, and it is literally just space. Not just empty space, but another solar system. They almost get sucked out. they cause a whole low pressure event and a storm happens. And unfortunately, one old lady dies. Poor Mrs. Knight gets sucked into the apartment, which isn't an apartment. It's a portal to outer space. And Mrs. Knight dies kind of funnily. And, well, I think it's funny in the night sky. After that, things start really ramping up. And towards the end of the novel, one of the characters that has been in this cast of characters turns out, like any Lovecraftian story, he's part of a cult. And the reason that this whole building was created by the guy who was murdered at the beginning of the book is to stop these horrible Lovecraftian-style monsters from invading the Earth. So, of course, this cult that Andrew, that guy...
The Red Death, they're called.
Yeah, the family, the Red Death. So, what this whole cult is trying to do is they know about these extra-dimensional creatures, and they worship them as gods. And they want to destroy the machine that the creator of the building made. And they didn't realize that the whole building was the machine. So at the end, now that Andrew knows what it is, they find the control room and they basically turn off the machine. And that's the whole ending of the book, is everybody who's in the Cavatch building gets taken to a alternate dimension, which is still Earth, but you find out alternate dimensions are a thing. And in this version of Earth, all these giant monsters have destroyed everything. And at the end of the story, they have to figure out how to turn back on the building and get back to our world. And they're now the guardians of this whole machine. And that's a quick and dirty synopsis of this whole story from beginning to end.
I think that's what makes the story creepy. Especially the way the predators are described is, you know, if you're familiar with the Cthulhu legend, you know, that's kind of what the alpha predators are kind of described as, except there's multiple of them. It's not just, and there's one big one, but there's a bunch that are like football field sized creatures, and those aren't even the biggest ones. And there's, the scene that always leaves me very unsettled is the realization when they go to the alternate dimension and they look and they see that, oh, there's humans. But they realize they're more like Neanderthals. So clearly, this universe never got to the evolution to humanity. Mm-hmm. So they were cavemen, essentially. That's what they, you know, and they're enslaved. They have these metal collars around their neck. They're literally livestock.
Yeah.
Which makes the alpha predator's creepy thing that he constantly repeats telepathically, you know, my food, my own, my prey, my cattle. Much more unsettling because literally, cattle. That's what he wants. You know, he wants to invade and make everyone on Earth, all 6 point whatever billion of us, into cattle, essentially.
Yeah. That is... I didn't get really into it in the quick synopsis there, but there's a point where they describe why this is happening, and the whole series that this is part of is called the Threshold Universe. So the guy at the beginning of the story who was murdered by the family of the Red Death... which is sort of a, now that I'm thinking about it, it's a reference to Poe.
Yeah.
That guy, that scientist, his name was Khodorovich, and he had a theory that whenever there was a certain population on Earth, that everybody's collective psychic energy was going to weaken the barrier between dimensions to allow these things to invade. So his machine is designed to stop that from happening. And it has been doing that for the last, like, 100 years.
Yeah, I think it's, like, 1890-something.
Yeah, because the electrical engineer Khodorovich works with is Nikola Tesla, who, when this book came out, was really, like, big on the internet. Not that he's not still, like, everybody's favorite. Everybody likes Tesla, nobody likes Edison.
See, I prefer Edison.
You prefer Edison?
I like winners.
You like brutal, vicious winners.
Yep. I'm from Pittsburgh. Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Edison and Carnegie would have get along if they got along with anyone, which I don't really feel they did. But, yeah, and another thing that gets thrown in is how the financing behind it was Whipple Phillips. And Whipple Phillips is H.P. Lovecraft, Howard Phillips Lovecraft's actual grandfather. Yeah, his name was Whipple, which is always fun to say, Whipple.
Whipple.
So, like, that's a cool detail. And the little implication that's thrown in there that I like is that Lovecraft's whole stories were based off of stories that Whipple told him about these actual alpha predators that Khodorovich was stopping with his giant machine. And obviously, in reality, that's not what happened. But in this fictional universe, that's actually, I thought that was a really cool detail.
It's one of my favorite little details because it gives this universe some depth. Mm-hmm. You know, because I love the idea of, you know, the revelation that, you know, the stories we love aren't just stories.
Yeah, it's that whole idea of there's a kernel of truth in any legend.
Yeah, and I kind of like the idea that, if in this universe, how this writer got these ideas, I like that. I think it's clever, and I think it really does make it an interesting little, like, it's a very minor twist. It's because it's almost kind of a throwaway twist when compared to the fact that now there's these giant, you know, 1,000 feet high alpha predators, you know, with tentacles and, you know, look like big whales. So it's kind of like, oh, yeah, by the way, H.P. Lovecraft, yeah, I got all these legends from this real universe.
Yeah.
Which I think is a nice, it almost feels like it's a throwaway, but I think overall it does add a little bit of sort of oomph to the story.
Yeah, and this is one of those stories where it works so well for me because I love Lovecraftian stories. I love horror. I love science fiction. And that, like, it's hard for me to, like, pick out any, like, flaws in its plot. But if I were going to, like, pick on one thing above all else is, so Peter Kleins wrote this story and it takes place in Los Angeles. And my assumption for why he did that is because he's very familiar with Los Angeles. He lives there and has a couple film credits and he's works in the movie industry. That's why whenever you read this story, you'll get a lot of like references to like the film industry. He talks about grips at some point. And the thing that I pick on is the whole building is being powered by this fault line under LA. And it's these tunnels underneath. And whenever it's Nate, Roger, and Zila are exploring down those tunnels, at one point, like, Roger is stretching and pushes on a beam, and it, like, falls over. And then, like, little bits of rocks fall. And it's basically all just very loose sandstone. And, like, it could easily be knocked down. And if you think about that, if the first fucking earthquake that would happen would, you know, destroy the building, and if the building was destroyed, then the horrible squid whale monsters would attack us. And, like, earthquake is a thing that happens in LA. I checked. A few times it has happened in the last 100 years. So if I'm going to pick on anything, that's the thing I pick out that, like, that doesn't exactly ring true, that how the building is powered would work.
I never actually thought of that, because they talk about earthquakes several times in the book.
Yeah.
But yeah, I never put that together. When he leans in the beam, like, you could have taken the whole building down. Really? This like, kind of little putzy dude who just leaned on it?
Yeah.
Could have taken the whole building down? Then your building's not very well built. I mean, you think if you're going to have a building that's, like, keeping our entire reality alive,
you'd want it a little more
secure. Reinforce a little bit. And does it have to be in L.A.? Because, I mean, could it be somewhere like in the Midwest where not a lot of stuff happens?
Until, like, fracking happened and then...
Yeah, maybe, like, move it to Toledo, Ohio. No, listen, man. No, nothing's happening here. No one's here. No one's going to look at this building. No one would question a $500 a month in Toledo. They're like, oh, that seems kind of expensive. I'm not going to live there.
Yeah, it's still... Oh, what is this? The Ritz-Carlton?
In Toledo, you could buy a house for about $500. I'm sorry, if you're from Toledo out there, I'm sorry, but your average median house is $90,000 for a reason. I'm sorry. I looked it up. This I know.
You're going to offend our one listener from Toledo, who is our one listener from planet Earth. I mean, we aren't talking obscurity for no reason.
That's true. But No, I never. I think it's interesting because, like, I actually love the scene before when they're just because they're going the way it's described. They're like walking for like 4 or 5 hours just in these like underground, cavernous nothingness under your building, which is so like interesting. And I love the way the fact that it's described is it's a workplace. Whoever left had all the attention in the world of coming back the next day.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's hit several times that it's very much just it's so routine for how weird it is. Which I think makes it even weirder.
That, like, people used to work in this building, and there was probably what happened to it is what happens to everything. Funding ran out. So, like, they just basically closed it, and there's a company that, like, a shadowy company that, like, sends the representatives to get them to, for people to rent. But, like, the girl that he meets at the beginning of the girl that Nate meets at the beginning who shows him it, turns out she's an actress. She doesn't even work for that company because he meets her like later
at a coffee shop. Like, yeah. She's like a Starbucks or something.
And so super weird shadowy company, like kind of oversees it. But you also get the idea like, because at the end, whenever, so Oscar, the building manager that was always kind of thwarting him, he gets taken to the new dimension, the other dimension with him, and he's about to like reveal how he's gonna get them back, and then one of the squales, which is what they call those squid whales, like rips him out, and it's this horribly brutal scene where like he goes, all we have to do is just ripped out a window, and soul of optimism, they go and try to find Oscar, and somebody even says, and it was like one of my favorite lines is like they didn't take him out there to hug.
They did find him though.
Yeah, they did find him in like two halves.
They found, you know, the way it's described is so brutal because it's like not just split in half, but his ribs are still like protruding
out. Yeah.
Which is just disgusting, a visual to think about.
Yeah. And it's like his organs are hanging out from the top half of him.
Which if they're really tight on the pop culture references, someone would have said he could be okay.
Well, probably not now. Yeah. So like, there are moments that are a little grotesque like that in this. So if you're not looking for something that is going to ever like do any of that, then I wouldn't listen to this. Because another scene that I really like is Andrew, the cultist that
lives in the building.
That lives in the building and fucks everything up for everybody. His aunt, Auntie, as he always calls her, is this horrible frog monster that is basically just pretending to be a person. And during what the attack from the squales, a shard of glass like the size of a dinner plate just hits her right in the head. And like whenever everybody's after the attack, like Tim's asking, is everybody okay? And Andrew pipes up after everybody reports in. He goes, Auntie's dead if anybody cares. And it's just like, we didn't.
Yeah, because as it turns out, you know, when you're causing the apocalypse, people aren't really that sympathetic to your death. As it turns out, I've never been there. I don't know.
Hopefully, I don't get to see the apocalypse. But
I love Andrew's a character that I genuinely, you know, his what's great about him as a character is you think he's this nothing, typical like boring religious dude. He's Flanders.
Yeah.
For the first, I would say 80% of the book.
Yeah.
Like, he shows up, he does things. He brings, like, carrots to, like, the group meeting and, like, or, like, unsalted crackers, like.
And he's polite.
He's very polite. And he's very much, like, this quiet, like, little religious dude that they all, like, don't like very much because he's, like, very preachy. So you think, okay, that's why. But then you find out he's, I would argue, the main antagonist of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, because the squid whales are just doing what they're doing. This guy is actually infiltrating them. Sure, he's weird, but, like, nobody ever thought that this little religious dude is ever going to be a threat. And he's shown to be pretty powerful, too, because whenever the control room that they mess up is actually somebody's apartment, because every room is somebody's apartment. And whenever he walks in, it's Debbie and Clyde's apartment, and he just backhands her across the room. And
punches him into, like, knocks him unconscious. Like,
yeah,
one punch.
And he has the rest of his little cult with him, and apparently being part of this cult makes you super strong and super weird, because, like, there's a description of the one of the characters where after he's dead, they have to move him out to, like, the back porch and away from everybody, and, it, like, it's he's described as grotesquely, like, he falls in that uncanny valley. And that's, like, the concept of, like, something so close to being human, but not quite. Like, the description I like the most is, like, his knees are too high on his leg. And they bend a little bit odd. And his face, when you look at it, there's nothing wrong with it, per se, but it's just, the proportions are just so slightly off that they're creepy. And I love that description of these cultists, is that they're all kind of like that. And if you think about the early descriptions of Andrew, he's a little bit like that too, because they describe how his hair is it's a very like plastic helmet hair kind of thing. And like his description is he's slightly weird. And like all of these people are like that.
It makes me wonder, because did these people come from the alt universe, or are they deformed through this belief? Because, you know, and here's the thing. I've always said this. If you have a universe where one crazy thing is real, you can't dismiss anything.
Yeah.
One of my biggest pet peeves in all fiction, there'll be a movie where, like, Godzilla's fighting, you know, Mothra in the sky. Mm. And it's like, oh, man, there's also a witch. That's stupid. How could there be a witch? Really? You're going to now, like, doubt, like, these crazy things?
Yeah.
Exhibit A, look up in the sky.
There's a giant moth fighting a giant dragon.
Like, so to me, like, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that, like, the worship of this cult deforms you in such a way. And the more longer you're a true believer, sort of the more like you're going, sort of the more you mutate into kind of looking like the very creatures you're worshiping.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that. And I think that they are specifically, this is my theory, that they're an homage to the Shadow over Innsmouth, which is a Lovecraft story. Shocking. I know.
What a world.
So, neo-Lovecraftian story references Lovecraft. So in Shadows over Innsmouth, what the Innsmouthians, I guess that's how you say what they are, Innsmouthians.
I like it.
Sounds as good as anything. Their whole thing is Innsmouth is near the fictional town of Arkham. Innsmouth itself is also fictional. And it's in New England by the water. And what is going on with them is they are inbreeding with these horrible fish people under the water. So they all kind of, like, first generations Innsmouth people all kind of look weird. And, like, they all have, like, these elder thing blood mixed in with human blood. That was a big thing for Lovecraft, that these things were, they weren't just cultists. They were also, like, their parents, for whatever reason, met fish people and thought, let's breed with these fish people.
Which, as you do.
Yeah.
I've never been tempted by a fish person. So I can't say one way or another if I would do that or not.
Until faced with a decision, how can you say what you're going to do?
Yeah, you can't know one way or another until you're, I mean, what are mermaids but fish people?
I'm in a catch-22 here, because Little Mermaid is my favorite movie as a child.
You fucking sicko.
I'm really... that fucking red hair and, like, oof, does it for me. Yeah, if they all look like Ariel, maybe I'd be an Innsmouth person. An Innsmithian. Like, that's disgusting. And then, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. It is what it is. You know, I think that, like, yeah, that's a good sort of, it probably is a reference to that, because this whole book is chock full of references to Lovecraft and different things like that. And really, just the whole idea of Cthulhu and the Alpha Predator, even if you don't literally hammer home the Lovecraft references,
yeah,
that they do. That's all that is. You can't do a alt universe creature without kind of homaging Lovecraft. It's mm-hmm. impossible.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, like, overall, what I really enjoy about sort of the homage and sort of the creature aspect of it is the creatures are really threatening and they are ominous. And at no point do you feel like there aren't a threat, because, you know, like, there's so many universes, so many versions of, like, you know, like, where you kind of do this story where there's the grunts that, you know, but all these things are threats. I mean, like, even the sort of slave masters that are enslaving
the humans,
the human, sort of human-like characters are played as very
threatening,
huge and threatening, and they're big.
And they kill Tim.
He kills him. And they talk about how strong they must be, because the way they throw the spear,
it's
lightning fast. It's like, yeah, coming up like a gun. You know, so what I think is sort of interesting is that this whole universe is threatening. And it kind of reminds me, and this is, again, Stephen King, who references Lovecraft, The Mist, that sort of story.
Yeah.
This is very, that's kind of what it reminds me of. Because there's that scene in The Mist, the movie, not the book, where that big creature's walking over, you know, the people as they're driving away. And that's, he's the sort of, this big creature that, what are they going to do with? Who knows? He can't beat it. It's too big.
Yeah.
But all the other creatures, whether they're small or medium or large, are also hugely threatening. Mm. There's not a single creature in that movie that isn't threatening.
Yeah.
And I think this book does a very similar job of every creature, whether they are, even the cockroaches, which aren't threatening, show you that something's amiss here.
Yeah.
Like they have sort of a purpose. And the thing is, they can't be killed.
Yeah.
And they can't, so even though they're not threatening, it shows you that this universe is not to be trifled with, because these are just the little cockroaches, and the only time you can kill them is when you get them out of the building.
Yeah, if you get that's a small detail in it, and I like the detail whenever they're doing the cockroaches is they don't eat anything, they just exist. You can put them in a terrarium and they just continue to live. It's literally they're tied to the building, they're tied to that alternate universe. And the only way to kill them is to get them too far away from it. So I think we're going to wrap up, do our parting thoughts at this point. And we're going to call this the end of the first episode. I hope everybody enjoyed it, all three of us. I'm going to download it. And I assume you're going to download it.
I'm not going to.
Okay. That's fair. So, yeah, my main thing is... I'm going to steal this from you. Like, rest in peace, Tim. You're too beautiful for this world. And, I mean, we didn't really have the time to really get into why he was such a cool character. I'm just going to leave that for you. You're going to have to figure out why he's a great character on your own.
Just read the book and embrace how great Tim is. Because Tim, you know, it's funny because, like, I as I was rereading this book, I haven't reread it since I finished it in 2015 or 16. I can't remember exactly. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
And I forgot how much I just genuinely loved him. Like, the moment he comes on, like, it's not even an exaggeration. Like, the moment I heard the voice, all those, like, warm, bubbly feelings came back. And it's like, oh, Tim. Literally, I texted you in real time, like, Tim, you beautiful bastard.
The fact that you die by spear.
And he's but the thing is, though, Tim is not the main character by any means. He's a good support. But this book is, if you had told someone that Veek was your favorite character, it wouldn't be that unrealistic.
Yeah.
This book does, and you know, it's about parting thoughts. You know, we're going to talk about why this book is good in sort of a short summary. Every character is, for the most part, is likable. Mm-hmm. And if not likable, they're interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's very rare to do an ensemble. Like, let's not even an ensemble where Nate is clearly your main character. But somehow he's still likable and you still really enjoy him. He's not like a bad character. But it works so strongly how likable everyone else is. Veek is super likable. Zila is really likable. Rogers. I mean, all of those people are just insanely enjoyable to hear and read because you like them and you root for them and you worry when they're in trouble, which I think is a sign of a good book.
Yeah. Well, again, I've been Kevin Carlson. And
I've been Steve Kubitz.
And we hope you read 14. Highly recommended.